comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thanks for being here. Some of you are joining us for the first time. Welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. Welcome to talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. I'm here because it matters, and so do you. Now, those of you who are subscribers to the K-Files e-zine, our free weekly e-zine, you received your e-zine over the weekend, and what you need to know is that right after I sent that out, it finished sending out. We started on Friday night, finished sending it all out on early Sunday morning. And right after that, the hard disk, the main hard disk in that computer, which is, by the way, the computer that runs the Kevin Smith Show TV channel. So KSS TV that you're watching, if you're watching, it's that computer. The main hard drive died. No symptoms, you know, usually there are little hiccups, little indications, you know, that something's going bad. It just died. Well, thankfully, we had a spare, and I installed the spare. And then I spent all day Sunday reinstalling software that we use to run everything, and we had backups of most of the data. Okay, I'll tell you what we didn't have backups of. I didn't have, and I don't often run backups of the email. Now, these backups are on another drive. Okay, now what this means is that some of you have submitted entries into the contest that we have going to get a logo for the Kevi Knights, right? We lost those. I am sorry, but they are in a dead hard drive. So, what I need is we're going to extend the contest for 1 week. We were going to announce the winner on the last show of September. We're going to go 1 week longer. And if you submitted an entry into that contest, you designed a logo for us and you sent it in, I'm sorry, but we're going to need you to send it in again, and I guess we'll learn the lesson and we'll back up the email along with everything else. But, you know, usually I don't keep email for more than a couple of weeks and then I delete it, and so I just don't back it up. These, however, should have been backed up. So, you know, send us an email and attach that logo to it, okay? Just attach that file to it. All right, as you know, Friday night my guest was to be Dr. Brooks Agnew. He encountered some weird things in arriving in Salt Lake City. And so when he got off the airplane, half of the city had no power, and everything that he had planned got shoved an hour later. And so he was just not able to be with us on Friday night. He is going to be with us tonight, and we're going to be talking about the very futuristic science that could be serving us right now. We'll be back right after this. Thank you. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I stated, my guest is Brooks Agnew. He is on the line with me, and we'll bring him on the air in just a moment. We're going to be talking about some really exciting technology that's going to be available to you very, very soon. And it's very futuristic. Before we do that, let me just put a bug in your ear, because I know we have a lot of people that subscribe to the K-Files e-zine, but the majority of you do not. And there's absolutely no genius in that. You missed big announcements because of that. But I'm going to go ahead and let you in on one, and that is that some of you missed when we did the seminar, the Gods in the Garden seminar, did it live on sort of closed circuit TV internationally, and we had an audience all over the world watching. We did the Gods in the Garden seminar back in May. Well, we videotaped that, and that videotape is what has become the DVD. But we are going to have a special showing of that on this coming Saturday. So if you want to get in on what you missed out on before, it's $25. There is a little ad on the main page of my website. You need to click and subscribe or register for that seminar. Now, the way this is going to happen, because it is pre-recorded, we don't have to do it at a specific time. So we're going to have three showings of it during that 24-hour period. All right, so you can pick the one that fits you best. Or if you're just really eager, you can watch all three. But you have to be registered. Registration closes midnight on the 24th. Okay? Dr. Brooks Agnew is many, 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 many things. Now, one of the things Dr. Brooks Agnew is, he's a best-selling author. Another thing Dr. Brooks Agnew is he's a scientist, and he is a businessman. He is involved. He's one of the real leaders on the right out on the leading edge of alternative energy. He is also the president of an automobile company called Global Green Cars. Dr. Agnew, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
You had kind of a bumpy arrival in Salt Lake City, didn't you?
Yes, we went down to Salt Lake City on Friday night, and there was a terrible windstorm, and it took out half the power. Literally, half the city was dark. And wouldn't you know it, that was the half of the city that we were going to our little night event down there. We got there, and the meal wasn't ready because there was no power to cook with. So we ended up missing the Kevin Smith Show on Friday night, and that was a... That's why we're here tonight. We want to make it right with your listeners.
Well, of course, we miss having you because it's always enjoyable when you're here on the show. But we understand that things like that can happen. I mean, it's happened to all of us at some time in our lives where everything you have planned just goes down the drain. And, you know, it happens. But I'm glad that you were able to be with us tonight. Because I'm really, really interested in talking with you about this very futuristic science. You know, that's one of the things we talk about here on the show. This is about paranormal. It is about, I mean, the show is about things paranormal. It is about UFOs, but it's also about space exploration and very futuristic science. You're involved in futuristic science. And you're involved in taking that and making it not just futuristic, but having applications where we can use it right now. One of those futuristic science projects, if you will, has to do with the biodiesel that you are involved with, and another has to do with the electric cars. Before we get to the electric cars, let's talk about the biodiesel just briefly. Because we haven't heard from you on that in a while. Where is that? I mean, by where is that? I mean, you know, where is it along the road of progress here?
Well, in January of 2009, we finished what we call our Stage 5 biodiesel plant. We had built one in Bakersfield, which was a scale-up from a proof of concept. It was capable of making about 10 million gallons a year. And the plant actually was responsible for the largest marine sale of biodiesel in the United States. And for a period of about a year and a half, it was the largest producer of biodiesel on the West Coast. So it was, like I said, a scale-up from proof of concept. The next unit was sold as a package deal to a rather large family in South Africa. And we actually thought that there would be lots and lots of orders from that, but they did not materialize. So the owner of the company, actually the president of the company, Joe LaStella, this is his brainchild, he calculated, or at least envisioned, that the best use of biodiesel was in somewhat rural communities where, like co-op farmers, could grow oil seeds and bring them to the plant, get them crushed, have those seeds turned into biodiesel, get back the high-protein meal for their farm animals and their feedlots, and establish some energy security in their region, because biodiesel, we believed, was a regional solution to energy independence, not a national one. Well, we got just such an opportunity in a little community in eastern Washington State. As luck would have it, there were 7,000 wheat farmers who had a co-op and who needed to grow canola as a rotation crop. Unfortunately, the closest canola market was in Canada, and they couldn't compete against Canadian rapeseed with their canola because the shipping costs made it prohibitively expensive. So they kept growing wheat on wheat on wheat on wheat, and their land was getting depleted. So we approached them and made a proposal that we would build them a biodiesel plant that had seed-crushing capabilities, provide them a local market for their canola, and provide them energy security with the subsequent biodiesel. Well, they partnered up with us, or we partnered up with them. And January of this year, we completed that plant, and it is on schedule to make 8 million gallons a year. And when they upgrade their license, we'll take them to 16 million gallons a year. But this has to be not ordinary biodiesel. This is exceptional biodiesel. It pours in cold weather. It stays fresh in the tank for months, perhaps even years, which are two shortcomings of typical run-of-the-mill biodiesel. The secret is, as you said, a very futuristic reactor, which was invented by Joe LaStella. And as he and I put our heads together, we took it from a proof of concept scale to a production level. And now it works every single time. It's very simple to run. It doesn't make any pollution whatsoever, no wastewater, no waste emissions to the atmosphere. And we're getting ready to build another one here in central Idaho.
Okay, so what does this portend now for the future? I mean, is it foreseeable that this could have a real impact on energy independence?
Yes, indeed. Now, I'll tell you, from a business standpoint, what has not worked. There have been companies that have come together and said, we are going to make 100 million gallons a year of biodiesel out of this plant. And they actually built the plant, started it up, and 2 years later it fell flat on its face. Why? Because biodiesel is a regional product. It competes heads up with what we call rack diesel or petroleum diesel, like you buy down at the gas station. There are several ways of using biodiesel. You can use it straight, 100% out of the spigot. It needs to stay warm. It needs to make sure that it runs in an engine that's compatible with it. Some engines, older engines, have rubber parts, and biodiesel will attack the rubber parts. But all the modern engines can handle biodiesel just fine. The preferred way to use biodiesel is to blend it with petroleum diesel. They started out with 2% blends, they went to 5%, 10%, and the premium blend is 20% biodiesel, 80% petroleum diesel. The reason this is so nice is when the EPA enforced the low sulfur requirements for diesel fuel, they removed the lubricity, the slipperiness, the oiliness from the fuel, and the engines are destroying themselves. These $250,000 tractor trailer rigs are going down right and left. $2,000 fuel pumps every other month. Engines are tearing themselves apart because there's no internal lubricant. Biodiesel replaces that lubricant. It also boosts the cetane number. That's like octane for gasoline, which means you get more power and you get better mileage. But the best thing of all is it removes the greenhouse gas effects of the petroleum diesel. It now becomes clean exhaust. So in order to make this function, in order to make it work, the solution is a network of smaller plants, 20 million gallons or less per year in regions around the country. Think how brilliant that would be to decentralize our fuel supply. How secure would our country be then if we were making 30 billion gallons a year of biodiesel in this country?
Well, yeah. I mean, it would be harder to target if someone had designs upon the country and decided to do something evil to us. Certainly, it would be harder to target. But wouldn't it make it more difficult to deliver?
Not necessarily, because it's all a local market. Everything goes in a local truck, goes to a local blender, goes out in a 200-mile radius from those plants, and it works just fine. Now, there are also natural disasters. You'll remember Hurricane Katrina hit Louisiana and caused our fuel prices to go through the roof. So there are natural disasters that can cause these upsets as well. And when we talk about increasing the amount of fuel in this country, the problem is we don't have the refining capability to make more diesel fuel in this country. We're tapped out. That's it. That's why we don't have a lot of diesel-powered cars, because there's not enough fuel. So what we're actually doing is we're increasing the refining capacity with respect to diesel fuel, which frees up the refineries we do have to make more high-value chemicals, like polymers for plastics, solvents, and various treatments and coatings. The oil companies make a lot more money off that stuff than they do diesel. So they don't really care if we make biodiesel or not.
All right. How does biodiesel compare price-wise per gallon with petroleum diesel?
Well, it costs, by the time you buy the canola, crush the oil out of it, bear with the fluctuations in market price. As you know, grain, seeds are all commodities. It's probably not as cheap as regular diesel. In fact, it might be as much as a dollar a gallon more. So much so that the federal government actually subsidizes the biodiesel industry about 99 cents a gallon to kind of even the playing field. But there are technologies coming, and this plant here in central Idaho is a key component. There's technology out there now that will stabilize that feedstock market. It's called algae to biodiesel. And this is going to bring the cost of biodiesel down. It's going to make it more stable. It's going to provide lots of jobs. And it's going to clean up a lot of those house gases that we are emitting out of our power plants.
Can biodiesel be used effectively in the generation of electricity? Is it scientifically effective and efficient for that?
It is in this sense. Biodiesel is about a 3-to-1 return on energy input. That is to say, the amount of sunlight that it takes to grow the various crops, whether it's camelina seed or whether it's canola seed or whether it's algae, the amount of electricity that it takes to process all of that and heat it and react it and deliver it is only 1/3 of the energy you get back. Not like ethanol. Ethanol for gasoline, you're lucky to get a 1-to-1 return. Usually it's about 0.9-to-1. In other words, you only get about 90% of what you put out. biodiesel is completely different. It's 300% return on energy investment. So it would be very, very effective to run generators off of to make electricity.
Okay, and that brings us to two questions. The first one is, with the government singing the songs that they've been singing about moving to a green economy and creating jobs, it's a pretty song, but how is that translating to on-the-ground reality? And the second is, how do we move to electric automobiles? But let's take the first one.
Okay, well, it actually makes a good segue, because in the biodiesel industry, there really aren't any major players, unless you want to count Exxon or, you know, Sinclair or some large company like that that's already in the oil business. And that's just more an effort to hedge their bets and consume all the grant money that's out there. But there are really only about 12 companies in the United States that actually have done proof of concept, have grown algae in large amounts. And, of course, one of them is our company, Green Star Products. Now, that being said, it's very difficult to raise investment money to grow algae to make biodiesel. It's just not something that people are doing routinely. This is, as you said, very leading edge, very futuristic science. So it is going to take a partner, and that partner has to be the federal government. They've got to be the first money in. Now, I've got to say, with respect to this science, the federal government's doing pretty well. This project here in central Idaho will receive a substantial grant from the federal government, which is not easy to receive. It's a very large, very complex application process. But if you can make it through that process, it's worth it. And so that industry is doing well with respect to subsidies and assistance from the federal government.
Okay, now, we have a break coming up. And we'll address what's happening with electric cars when we come back from break. But what you're saying is that the federal government is supporting the development of biodiesel.
Well, fortunately, at least in this respect, there's no such thing as a federal government. It is a loose coalition of bureaucracies. And the bureaucracy that happens to be dealing with biofuels and biodiesel is much more common sense and much more driven by the science and by performance of the individual company.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Sorry for the brief delay. As usual, you know, our technological things come in groups. Friday night was Brooks Agnew's turn. Tonight it's our turn. So I already told you about what happened with the hard drive over the weekend. And now it's a telephone line. One telephone line. Anyway, we are back. We are continuing. Things shall roll on. Okay, now, Brooks, when we stepped away for break, we were talking about that with regard to biodiesel, the particular agencies involved in funding that are doing a pretty good job. And
yes, yeah.
Okay, now,
what we see in the public eye on television, you see all the speeches and the rhetoric and the posturing and the vote for me, vote for me, vote for me. But the real government is just a loose coalition of bureaucracies, and they all have budgets and they all have projects that they work on, and some of them take great pride in what they do, and some of them just take great pride in being a government employee, if you know what I mean.
I do indeed. Okay, now, you are also involved in another area of clean energy, and that has to do with electric cars. You are the president of Global Green Cars. And as a matter of fact, for those who are watching, I'm going to put a photograph up from your website of one of the cars. And what they're looking at is the little green and white car that is on your site.
Right.
Now, how many?
The D1.
The D1. How many people can ride in that car?
That's a two-seater, but there's a lot of room behind the seats, about, for the average person, about 10 to 12 inches behind those two seats. So there's room for speakers or luggage or whatever you want to put on the inside of the car. Mm-hmm. And then there's a trunk in the front, and there's a trunk in the back.
All right. Tell us a little bit about this. Now, this is not the only model you've got. You also have a pickup model. And
that's the G1 is what you see on the front page of the website. The G3 is the small pickup truck. Now, it'll carry 1,000 pounds. It's a very torquey little work truck.
Okay. All right. Now, let's talk about the genesis of this car. I mean, there have been other electric cars. And one of the real problems, people love them, but one of the problems they had was range. You know, you just couldn't go very far because the batteries ran down. So in the genesis of this car, there obviously had to be some step forward, something that said, okay, we can do this and do it better than it was done. Tell us about that.
Well, in the early 90s, it was in 1992 we actually got wind of this. In 1993, California passed a clean energy mandate where government agencies, and they wanted this to spill over into the commuter market, would be about 2 to 5% all electric by the year 2003. It was a great opportunity for the electric car business. We weren't the only ones to respond. There were other companies that responded. And the government, the federal government, was kind of overwhelmed at first because they were getting all kinds of mixed signals from the consumer. Some of the cars would only go 20 miles on a charge. Some of them couldn't climb the least bit of hill at all. And some of them were unsafe. And so the government decided to put on a challenge called the EV Challenge. This was in 1995. And they invited all the car companies to bring their electric cars. And boy, did they respond. About 100 companies came out of the woodwork, not the least of which was GM and Chrysler. And then the government, in their realizing that they'd opened Pandora's box, modified that with an amendment that said, oh, by the way, there's no money in it, and you have 6 months to deliver your car. They all dropped out except four companies: Chrysler, Selectria, U.S. Electric, and Global Green Cars, which in those days was known as BAT International. So we built two vehicles for the competition, a Geo Metro and a Ford Ranger, using our technology. When the challenge began, the government didn't even have standards set. They really didn't know what to expect. They wanted to see more innovation. Well, the Chrysler vehicle was dead on arrival. We actually worked on it and helped them work on it and got it going each day so it could try to compete. The long story short, the Global Green Cars vehicle swept the whole thing in top speed, in braking, in distance, in hill climbing. There was no competition whatsoever. So since that time, 1995 to 1998, things looked like they were going to go pretty well. And then in 1998, suddenly, California withdrew their mandate. Now, rumors were that Detroit had sued them. Another was that Pete Wilson was going to run for president, and one of his concessions to get support from the automotive industry was to end the mandates in California. We're not really sure what happened, but the mandates ended. Gas was about $1.05 a gallon. and electric vehicles just could not compete in the open market. So we parked our vehicles and switched our concentration to alternative fuels. But in 2008, we had some natural disasters and some economic conditions that caused the price of fuel to go through the roof, and demand for electric vehicles went up with it. So we just rolled out our old 1994 vehicles, put fresh batteries in them, waxed them off a little bit, and they ran just as good as they did 15 years ago. Still one of the top performers out there. Now, we've made modifications in the controller and battery systems and made them much more efficient than they were back in the 90s. And we have four main advantages over all the other car companies out there. And there's actually six, and I'll explain the last two later. But the first four are we have a proprietary controller. This is the interface between the operator, the driver, and the electric motor. We also have a price point no one else can hit. We're at about $25,000 for our vehicles, and our nearest competitors are somewhere around $55,000 and going up. And that's primarily because of their choice of battery systems. They have chosen to put all their eggs in the lithium-ion basket. And all the world's lithium is concentrated in two countries, and they're not the United States. We're right back in the energy independence bind again. And those countries are Bolivia, which is not very friendly to anybody, and Peru in South America, Chile. So Bolivia decided to make a cartel out of it, and they're now doubling about every 3 months the price of lithium. A battery pack that would cost you $20,000 3 months ago will now cost you $40,000. That's a lot of money for a battery pack. So those car companies are essentially out of business right now. They're putting their models out there. They're putting a good front on. They're hitting all the car shows. But you can't buy one of those vehicles. So the third thing that we do with our vehicles is we provide multi-speed transmissions. All the other EV companies are going with one speed. They're taking advantage of that high torque motor. However, with respect to a pickup truck or a small car even, if you put it on a hill in a stop sign in the rain with the wipers going and the lights running and four people in the vehicle or 1,000 pounds in the back of the pickup, and you try to cross that intersection from a dead stop going uphill, guess what? That vehicle isn't going to move. So the multi-speed transmission is a major, major advantage that we have. We're the only multi-speed transmission EV out there.
So in essence, then, you could downshift in order to get going.
Oh, these things will climb a wall. If they wouldn't flip over backwards, they would go straight up.
Okay. But that's what the multi-speed transmission does. It allows you to downshift.
That's right. It multiplies your torque by using gears to make the rear wheels spin much slower in comparison to the motor RPM. So your motor might be turning 1,000 RPM and your back wheels might be turning, 20 RPM. But that helps you get started, especially mm-hmm. in tough conditions. The best thing about it is it allows the driver to control his driving conditions instead of the car forcing the driver to drive the way the car drives. That's a big advantage that we have. A lot of people start off in second gear in our cars, start off in third gear, but some people have a hill to climb or have a load to haul, and they go ahead and gear down because they have the choice. And those transmissions already exist out there. We don't have to invent new technology at very, very high capital costs.
All right, so let's say that I'm in a situation where I need to gear down. I go to first gear, and I climb the hill. I crest the hill, and now I'm headed down the other side picking up some speed. How does it work with the electric car? I mean, I know in a just a regular automobile, standard transmission, you push the clutch in and you shift gears to second, then to third, then to fourth or whatever. How does it work with your car?
Right now it works just like that. If it's not broke, don't fix it. So, in the future though, We hope to be moving on to solenoid shifters and even automatic transmissions Of course, we've got to change the dynamics a little bit. We don't need a torque converter because obviously when you come to a stoplight, there's no reason for the electric motor to sit there idling. It just comes to a stop, and you use no power. While you're in those traffic jams and all the gasoline-powered vehicles around you are belching pollution out that exhaust pipe, and I might add the car owner's money, mm-hmm. you're sitting there using no energy whatsoever and no pollution.
Okay, now you said there were... You said there are four basic reasons why you're more competitive than the others. I've noted three of them. Proprietary controller, price, and multi-speed transmission. We'll get to the fourth one on the other side of this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And my guest this evening, Dr. Brooks Agnew, he is one of the leaders in this country out on the leading edge of the futuristic sciences that will lead us to energy independence. Dr. Agnew, I had mentioned you had mentioned there are four reasons primarily that your car is ahead of the pack. We've heard three of them: proprietary controller, the price primarily due to the batteries, and then multi-speed transmissions. What's the fourth?
Well, the fourth, of course, when you're out on the leading edge, you cross the finish line first. So one of the main advantages that we have is that we are not hamstrung by all of the red tape and quality processes that the major car makers are tied down with. And what I mean by quality processes, each supplier that supplies a part to the main assembly plants has to go through a production part approval process. We call it a PPAP. Those PPAPs are expensive. Each company probably spends between $100,000 and $150,000 just proving that their part meets the quality standards of General Motors or Ford or Chrysler or Toyota or Nissan. The problem with that is there's no common sense in the system. It's designed, I think, to keep out-of-work accountants busy, but they have lost sight of the reason why they're in business. The reason why they're in business is to deliver an affordable product at a profit. And they have forgotten how to do that. What they try to do is make the product cheap, not inexpensive, but cheap, so that they can make a profit while charging you $40,000 or $50,000 or even $70,000 for an electric vehicle. So what we have done is we have short-circuited those things, because I come from that industry after 20 years and as a Six Sigma black belt, which is a quality, a way of applying mathematical tools to the manufacturing industry. What we've done is we've shortcutted all of the redundancy out of that system, and we've allowed ourselves to go from concept, that is paper, to a finished vehicle in 9 weeks. That is a major, major manufacturing advantage. Now, there are two other things I want to mention at this time, and they are related to safety. When we built our cars back in the 90s, we used DC, direct current motors, and we did not convert the battery power into alternating current. We stuck with the DC motor. Now, some might say, well, gee, that's old technology. But it really isn't, and I'll tell you why. Because when you go to that AC motor, yes, you pick up torque, but you have to go to three-phase 480-volt AC power. Now, there's a difference between getting hit with 144 volts DC, which is a little tingle on the arm, and 480 volts AC. It drops you like a sack of potatoes. It will kill you. And 480 volts AC in those cars, wires running through metal conduit or tunnels in the car. When that car gets in an accident, that car could be a live 480 volt powerhouse, and the first person that touches that car is going down. Firefighters are going through training right now, learning the wiring codes for these new electric vehicles coming out, so they don't stick the jaws of life on the wrong wire. And there's one more safety concern, and that is some of these vehicles are out there with 90,000 watts of power, 90 kilowatts. That's available as an AC field, three-phase, right between your legs. You are driving in an alternating current electrical field. You think your cell phone can cause damage to you after a while? Wait till you drive that car for a few years.
Now, you see, that's something that in various conversations that I've had with others, this is the first show I've done about electric cars, but with various conversations that I've had with other people, having something to say about, you know, we need electric cars, no one has pointed that out. But, you know, that makes sense. Now, let me just say, with the radar units that police use in their vehicles, everyone has seen police using what looks like a gun. It's a radar gun. It's a portable unit. Those were developed primarily for motorcycle cops. But they also exist in some patrol cars. And there's a warning that all the cops are given, and that is, don't lay this in your lap.
Oh.
Now, the reason is the radar gun, it has... it's got a trigger on it. It's got a switch. And, you know, you would think, well, okay, that's when it transmits. That's right. That's when it transmits. But even if you're not pulling the trigger, all of that power that runs the transmission is still coursing through the unit. And if you lay it in your lap, there's a big percentage of cops who used to do that that experienced testicular cancer. And they didn't know. Now they know. And so it comes with a warning. Don't lay this in your lap. Okay, so you can lay it on the seat over on the passenger side and pick it up when you need to use it, but you don't lay it in your lap. And that's just from the power running the radar unit.
That's about 300 watts. We're talking about 90,000 watts. When mm-hmm. you step on that accelerator, you are generating a electromagnetic field, three-phase alternating current. And this, some of this can be very high frequency, by the way. These are variable frequency motors, and they run at high frequency. I know that, for instance, one of the car makers that is bragging that they've got a great car out there, their engine, their motor, runs at 15,000 RPM. Now, I don't know if you ever raced cars, Kevin, but I raced cars most of my life. Nothing stays together very long at 15,000 RPM. And when it comes apart, it's going to come apart explosively.
When you say explosively, I mean, you know, I can see explosive if it were using gasoline or some other petroleum fuel, but you're saying that this electrical engine can explode.
That's right. You take an 8 or 9 inch diameter armature and you spin it at 15,000 RPM and it goes out of balance, or that bearing seizes up and snaps that shaft off, that armature is now a 15,000 RPM saw blade and it is going to go through something. Race cars, we use what's called a splatter shield. It's a Kevlar blanket that's bolted around the transmission so that just in case the engine blows up, shears the end off that crankshaft, the flywheel doesn't come through the bell housing and through the floorboard and into the driver. These electric vehicles are going to have to be equipped with that kind of safety measure because they're going to be spinning at very, very high RPM. That's how these AC motors get their power. DC, not so. It's a very low RPM, low torque motor, very safe. In fact, the DC electric fields have been shown to be healthful.
Let's back up and cripple that and run that past me again. The fields off of the DC motors have been shown to be helpful?
That's correct.
In what way?
They are beneficial for biosystems because the human body runs on DC. And what happens to human cells over time is as they divide all about every 7 to 8 years.
Hate to do it. We have to step away for break. We'll come up with the human cells when we come back from break. We'll be back, folks. Don't go away. Welcome back. My guest is Dr. Brooks Agnew, and we are discussing the very leading edge technologies that really could be benefiting us right now. One of the things we discuss on this show very often, people talk about, you know, they want UFO disclosure, and so do I. And they're saying, you know, if we had disclosure of UFO information, we very likely would have information that could lead to energy independence, perhaps free energy. And the important thing to note, concomitant with that, is that there's technology available to us right now that could lead to energy independence to a great degree, if not entirely. And we're talking with Dr. Brooks Agnew. Dr. Agnew is the president of Global Green Cars. He is also one of the leading proponents involved and scientists involved in biodiesel. We talked about that first. Now we're talking about these electric cars. When we went away for break, Dr. Agnew, you were describing for us how DC, the electrical field of DC, has actually been shown to be beneficial rather than harmful to humans. And we had to cut you off in mid-sentence because the break was taking over. So let me ask you to sort of recap that for us.
Okay. The human body runs on DC. Every little cell in your body is just like a little DC power supply. About every 7 or 8 years, most of the soft tissues of the body, like the epithelial cells in your mouth and esophagus and down through your colon, and your dermal cells, that's the highly capillarized tissues underneath the skin, are completely replaced over a period of time. About every 7 or 8 years, it's a complete changeover. Every 14 years, just about all the cells in the body, except the teeth and the gray matter of the brain, is changed out. Each time it's changed out, the cells replace at a slightly lower voltage. And over time, the skin cells and muscle cells and even bones lose their elasticity, they lose their ability to resist ultraviolet light, they lose their ability to heal, and we age. It has been shown repeatedly, clinically, that exposure to DC magnetic fields can actually recharge the cells of the body temporarily, 24 to 48 hours. If that cell happens to die during that time and it divides and it replaces itself, it's going to replace at the higher energy. We have seen marvelous health benefits from this. In neurosurgery, they do what's called deep brain stimulation, where they bore a small hole in the skull, they set a tiny magnetic coil down into the brain, they put a small amount of voltage on that, generate a magnetic field inside the brain, and turning on all those memory capabilities, reversing the effects of Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. It is really amazing to watch.
So, okay, now that's done with DC current?
That's done with DC current, direct current, just like the cars run off of.
Okay. All right, now, let's talk about some practical things related to these cars. We ought to park there and talk about that for a little while before we talk about some of the practical considerations. I guess what you're saying is that these cars can, in essence, sort of help keep you younger.
Well, I like that idea. It's kind of a youth machine. But I can tell you, I've been personal witness in the last 3 years of DC magnetic fields being applied to biological systems in humans, and I've seen the beneficial effects. And there are probably thousands of your listeners that already know all about this. It's called Tesla technology. There's Reiki. There's all kinds of applications for this kind of exposure to these DC electromagnetic fields. AC, not helpful. The higher the frequency, the more harmful it is to you.
Okay. So the more I drive my car, the more health benefits I get from it.
Well, I'd like to think so, yes. And time will tell. You know, as you get right now, well, let me put it this way. In 2008, 16.5 million new cars sold in America. Zero of them were electric because there are no crash-tested, highway-ready electric vehicles yet. That's coming, and hopefully we have a crash test date set in January. We're going to be the first one out of the gate. Certainly we'll be the first one out of the gate with a crash-tested pickup truck. We'll have a market of about 800,000 vehicles all to ourselves for a couple of years. So the company's going to do quite well. I'm not worried about that. The electric vehicle demand is something a lot of people really have missed. When we sold vehicles back in the 90s, we were very careful about who we sold the vehicles to. We made sure they had two cars already, and this was going to be a third car, and you know, we made sure that they knew they couldn't go more than 100 miles and those kinds of things. But, you know, consumers will do what they will do. And what they did time after time after time is they parked their gasoline-powered cars and they drove the electric. They drove it everywhere, to the store, to the movies, to the soccer games, to work and back, and they only bought gas like once every 2 or 3 weeks. In essence, they were saving money. So we did some calculations, and the average family will save about $4,000 a year by driving our cars.
All right. You brought up a range of things in the realm of practical considerations that I said we'd talk about, so let's talk about them. What about the range of these vehicles? How far can I go in the G1? How far can I go before I have to recharge, and how fast can I go there?
Well, the G1 is a sporty little car. It kind of looks futuristic. It's a cross between a Prowler and a Volkswagen, I guess. It only weighs 1,150 kilos, so it's pretty light, about 2,300 pounds. And you can go about 100 miles on a charge with the current battery technology. Now, the funny thing about battery technology, you read recently or heard in the news, something like $111 million was given to a battery company in Indiana, which is actually a Korean battery company called Enerdell. The interesting thing about all this battery technology is there's no place for it to go because there aren't any electric vehicles on the road. You can get what's called a neighborhood electric vehicle, something that goes 25 miles an hour or less, thanks to the Department of Transportation and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. They have decided that you can't drive an electric vehicle over 25 miles per hour unless it's been crash tested with airbags and side guardrails and roof crush specifications added to it. So there aren't any electric vehicles on the highway today. If they are, they're converted regular highway cars that have already been crash tested, but they're in very, very low volume. That means there's no market for battery technology right now. It may be developing out there, but there's no market for it. So one of the key business decisions we made is open architecture, because electrons are electrons. And we know after we get about 120,000 of our vehicles out there on the road, guess what? Now we have a spot on the road for advanced battery technology that can sell, not just be developed and go through a bunch of grant money and sit on the shelf somewhere. Get out there on the road and be used. When the demand is there, the battery technology will come. So that little G1 that can go 100 miles today might be able to go 200 miles or 250 miles in a couple of years. But let me let you in on a little fact. The DOT conducted a national household survey, 10,000 households, all kinds of demographics. The average work is absolutely stunning. 95% of people drive less than 75 miles a day. And 75% of people drive less than 50 miles per day. I'll take that market right there. If I can hit 50% of the market or 75% of the market with our cars, I'm happy. And we'll add something to it. If you buy a Global Green Cars automobile, you'll get 5 days of free rental car a year. So if you want to take a trip longer than 100 miles, take our car. We'll pay for the rental, you buy the gas. The rest of the year that you're driving those little short trips, 30, 40, 50 miles a day, drive the electric.
Well, yeah, you know, most people during the day-to-day driving, you know, they're just going, they go to work, and they take the kids to the school, maybe pick the kids up from school, and go home, and that's about it. Run to the grocery store.
Yes.
And that's about it. All right.
Right.
So, how long does it take to fully recharge the batteries for the G1, and does it require any special hookup?
Two excellent questions. We decided to make the cars run on either 110 volts or 120 volts. Just about everybody has a 110 or 120 outlet in their garage. So you pull the car in and you plug it in, just like you would a blow dryer. Now, as to how long it takes to fully recharge, that kind of depends on how hard you drove the car that day. If you're creeping into your driveway with about 30 volts running, and you've just about 100% depleted those batteries, you're probably looking at an 8 or 9 or even 10-hour recharge, because it's all about kilowatts. If you've got a 20-kilowatt battery system and you're putting 10 or 11 amps in at 120 volts, add it up. It takes about 10 or 11 hours to recharge that battery, which is overnight. But most people drive 40 or 50 miles in a day. They're not going to fully deplete those batteries. So that car will probably recharge in about 4 or 5 hours. And what happens is people get used to, when they park somewhere for a period of time, say half the day or all day at work, they just plug the car in, and then it's always ready to go.
Well, I would think there might be, especially for businesses that do a whole lot of singing in the choir about being a green business, there might be the possibility they would install some places in their parking lot where you could plug in.
You bet. Absolutely. You're only talking about maybe 10 or 11 amps that these cars draw. You could fill up the car for about $1 worth of electricity. And that means you can drive 100 miles on a dollar, which means you can drive 300 miles on $3. Which is about what 1 gallon of gas costs today. Now, if you do the math, it's not hard. The cars get a 300 mile per gallon equivalent, dollar for dollar.
Well, that sounds good. And you said these will save us somewhere around $4,000 a year.
Yeah, average household spends about $300 to $320 a month in gasoline. And it's not households that are seeing the benefit. you take the average small town of, say, 25,000 people, the vehicle that the city runs, just the meter reader trucks and the city park trucks, do you realize that their gasoline bill is somewhere around $20,000 a month? How about the taxpayers asking their cities to replace half their fleet with electric pickup trucks, cutting that fuel cost to $10,000 a month? If you do the math really quickly, you're seeing $1.2 million saved in a single year just from gasoline purchases in a community. Are you sick and tired of those tax increases, those property tax increases? That's where it comes from, the cost of fuel.
Okay. Now, in order for your car to be available for someone to go down to a dealer and buy, or to buy it from directly from the factory, I don't know how you're going to distribute them, but in order for it to be available, it has to leap some hurdles for the federal government. You mentioned the Department of Transportation and the National Highway Safety Administration. What sort of hurdles have to be leapt, overcome, in order for your car to be available to the public?
Okay, there is a set of standards called the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. This is, over the years, they have determined through, obviously, hundreds of thousands of auto accidents and lots of insurance claims, what features need to be in the average car in order to prevent bodily injury to the driver or to the crash dummy. And those safety requirements need to be installed in these cars. Used to be it was 1.5 times the vehicle weight on a what's called a roof crush test. They actually have a giant pneumatic foot that steps on top of the car. Now that's been increased to 3 times the vehicle's weight. They're finally starting to incorporate race car standards into these cars. Haven't you been fascinated by these NASCAR cars that can slam into the wall at 120 miles an hour? Next thing you know, the guy's slurping on a Pepsi and the camera saying, "I'm fine, not a scratch on me." Wouldn't you like to be able to hit the wall at 120 miles an hour, not more than once, of course, in the average sedan and be able to walk away like that? Sorry, you can't, because those standards are not tough enough for the average passenger car. Well, they're getting better. Airbags certainly help, but somehow the structural part of that driver cockpit needs to be strengthened in such a way that it can take that kind of impact with a driver being able to walk away. Those capabilities are being designed into our vehicle as we speak. And in January, we have to take 5 brand new vehicles and smash them. Once in the front, once from the rear, once from the passenger and driver's side, and then crushing the roof.
Okay, now let's assume that you get through all these crash tests. How soon, will you pass all the crash tests, how soon after that will these vehicles be available?
I would say answer unknown, but I'll give you a range. I would say second or possibly third quarter of 2010, you'll be able to go down to the dealership and buy a Global Green Cars automobile. How is that going to be done? Well, in case you have a friend out there that happens to be a new car dealer, he'll tell you the same story. The car dealers, the Automobile Dealer Association will tell you this if you go to their website. The automobile dealers are being squeezed from two sides. One is through the state license franchise that they have with the supplier of their cars, be it Ford, GM, Chrysler, Toyota, Nissan, whatever. Those rules and regulations have gotten so stiff on the dealers, they're finding it hard to do business. On the other end, it's the car supplier. General Motors actually shut down production for a while because they had a little hiccup called bankruptcy. Oh, that's right, the taxpayers bailed them out of that. And then Chrysler also went bankrupt. Ford decided not to go bankrupt. They just slowed things down enough where they could continue to make a profit. Who pays for it? the dealer pays for it. So we have a clean slate and a very innovative strategy for working with American automobile dealers for getting electric vehicles into their showroom and into the hands of consumers as quickly and economically as possible.
Okay. You also have a whole bunch of dealers that were put out of business, even some of them that were profitable, that were put out of business by the alleged bailout. Now, here's an interesting thing. I don't know if you really want to answer this, but you are now in competition not only with GM and Ford and Chrysler, but you're in competition with the United States government, who, because of the bailout, they own GM, and regardless of what people may want to tell you, they own a big, substantial part of Chrysler. So you're in competition with Uncle Sam.
That's right. And you have the elected officials, like the president, who are hitting the bully pulpit almost every week saying, we want to help innovation, we want to help small business, we've put forth $3 billion toward the help of bringing forth electric vehicles. I'm here to tell you, straight up, horse's mouth, that's a load of crap. And I can say that on the radio, can I?
Yeah.
Here's the deal. There was one grant. Now, there was several loan guarantee programs, which are pretty tough to get. You have to be made of solid gold to get them. But the grants, there's only been one. That grant, the total amount was $378 million. We calculated that was about lunch money for a week for General Motors. They wouldn't go after it. So we went after that grant, and we submitted an excellent application. With all of our history and all of our world records that we hold in the electric car business, we thought we stood a pretty good chance. And the Department of Energy thought so, too. And they wrote us a congratulations letter, told us that we had passed our merit review, and we were going on to the next phase. The next thing we knew, literally a couple weeks later, Obama is standing in Indiana giving away $378 million to Ford, GM, Chrysler, and Nissan. Not one single electric vehicle company got a dime out of that grant. None. And that really made us mad.
All right. Now, that means then that we're hearing the choir sing that we're going to convert to green economy. We're watching the choir, that being the boys in Washington, and boys and girls in Washington, instead of going green, buying into the old technology of GM.
Well, not, you would think that, yes, that eventually you're going to see an electric vehicle out of these companies. Nothing could be further from the truth. The only reason these companies went for those grant funds is to keep it out of the hands of the electric vehicle companies. Mark my words, the American public will never be able to buy an electric vehicle in this country as a result of that grant.
Okay, so that means we're not going to be able to buy your car?
Not so, because we are not funded that way. We're funded by private investors.
Mm-hmm.
We have no debt, we're streamlined, and we have a key word working for us. It's called agility. It doesn't matter how big you are, how well-known your name is, how large your buildings are, how well-known your logo is. If you're not agile, you're not going to survive in this economy. We're agile, and we're sensitive to the customer. And in our surveys that we conducted over a year ago, we found nobody cares about brand name when it comes to electric vehicles. They just want the car.
All right. Now, we had this situation that everyone is familiar with, where there were a whole bunch of electric vehicles out there. I forget if it was GM or Chrysler. I think it was GM that put them out there. And then they all got recalled after a test period, and they had to be crushed. They had to be destroyed. And lots of people lobbied to keep their car and were not able to do so. When we come back from break, we'll take that up. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking this evening with Dr. Brooks Agnew. Dr. Agnew is one of the foremost leaders and proponents of energy independence technologies. And when we went away for break, Dr. Agnew, I was saying that we all remember that experiment with the electric cars, and a number of people around the country had them. They loved them. They wanted to keep them, and there was a recall. And they all had to turn their cars in, and they were destroyed. What's up with that?
Well, you're talking about the EV1, which was a program General Motors put out. They had a pretty aerodynamic little sedan called the EV1, and they produced about 100 or 200 S10s as well. These were pickup trucks that had the EV1 technology in them. The problem was that they way over-designed these vehicles. I don't mean they were over-designed to high quality. I mean the vehicles were so complicated that in order to get an EV1, first of all, you had to go through a 3-day class, and then you had to prove economic stability, like a net worth over $200,000. You had to prove that you own two cars already. You had to go through a class and be trained how to drive this car. When they released the cars the first week, over 200 of them had to be towed in. We were competing against GM at that time. In fact,
that sounds like an Audi I had one time.
Yeah, about.
Listen, I was driving home from the dealership, and the car had to be towed.
Right. Right. That was the problem. Well, we were competing against General Motors at that time, in a sense. The current CEO of General Motors at the time, his name was Stimple, actually sent customers to us because we were building a much more economic vehicle. Our vehicle cost around $19,000 in those days. And no training required. Just drop the keys in your palm and take off. And they drove just like, in fact, they drove better than the gasoline version, Geo Metro. And customers were quite satisfied with it. And all those times that we let them out, we only had to have one towed in. And that's because the person didn't charge the car up for a week. It finally ran out of energy. So the reason the EV1s were gathered up, and they probably did the industry a favor, because had they put those EV1s out there, they would have been a maintenance nightmare for General Motors, and they knew it. So they gathered them up and they crushed them. Now, I know a gentleman who managed to save one of the pickup trucks, one of the S10s, and I actually lifted the hood on that truck, and he has done a lot of maintenance on that truck himself to keep it running. The truck has no payload. That means you couldn't put a cooler of ice in the back of it because all the payload is taken up with batteries. So you have a nice pickup truck, but you can't put anything in the back except air.
Okay, so that brings up a question. Are the batteries in your cars wet cell or dry cell?
They're not dry cell and they're not wet cell. They're membrane technology. It's not a flooded battery. It's nickel-based, very safe, very environmentally friendly. They still weigh more than what we want them to. But as battery technology gets better, we'll improve the density of the batteries. We may even change technology of the batteries. And there's always what's called the extended range hybrid. Now, we're not talking about a hybrid like a Prius. A Prius goes 10 miles on a battery, and the rest it runs on gasoline. So it's basically a gasoline-powered car with a battery helping to improve the mileage. And it doesn't really do that much good. Extended range hybrid technology is a little bit different. This is a small generator that only charges the batteries. The batteries still drive the vehicle, but the generator just trickle charges the batteries. Now, some of your listeners, Kevin, are out there with this generator technology sitting on a bench or sitting in their garage, and we want that technology. We don't want to put a little Honda generator in the back of these things, sputtering one cylinder down the road, vibrating and using gasoline. Somebody's got a generator out there that puts out 10 or 12 amps at 150, 160 volts DC, and that's what we need in these little cars.
Have you taken a look at adding the possibility of solar energy charge while the car is just sitting in the parking lot, having a trickle charge off of solar energy?
It'll work. You'll get a couple of amps out of it, and certainly on a sunny day, you might be able to keep the batteries kind of fresh. And there are also regenerative braking technologies. We've experimented with lots and lots of regenerative braking technologies. Bottom line is they cost about $2,000 just in parts to put the regenerative braking on the car, and you only get about maybe 8, maybe 12 miles more range out of the vehicle. At the end of the day, you never get paid back for the regenerative braking because nobody drives more than 100 miles anyway. So we made the car affordable, somewhere around $25,000. The first 100,000 vehicles that come off the assembly line will get somewhere around a $3,000 rebate from the federal government. That's a nice benefit, helps you with the down payment. But the real benefit is not having to buy that gasoline. That savings, you can just about drive the car for free. The savings on gas will make your car payments, and when the car is paid off, you continue to put that money in your pocket. And the higher gas goes, the more you save.
What about financing?
Well, that's a good question. When a car meets the value, that is to say the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, then the banks will finance new cars just like they do other new cars. And of course, because there are a lot less moving parts in an electric vehicle, the warranties are much better. We have a 15-year warranty on the drivetrain in these cars. The motors will last much, much longer than that. But that gives a level of security for the buyer when they go to buy a Global Green Cars automobile. They know it's going to last.
Okay, now the battery pack, how long before I have to replace that?
That's a good question, too. It depends on the driver. If the driver is an aggressive driver, he's going out there beating his batteries up every day, racing, driving to the very, very end of the limit of this battery, draining it all the way down and then recharging it all the way back up, the battery's not going to last very long, 2 or 3 years, and they're going to be toast. Susie Homemaker, who's taking her kids to the soccer game, going to the grocery, going to work at the school, her batteries are going to last a lot longer, 5, maybe 6 years. As I said, battery technology is going to get better and better as the demand begins to form. Right now, there's no demand for electric vehicle batteries.
All right.
The nice thing is that with the open architecture design, as the batteries get better and better, you don't have to change cars. You just change batteries.
How expensive is that?
Well, our batteries are running between $5,000 and $6,000 for a set of batteries. Lithium ion, just to get started with lithium ion, you're probably talking $25,000 for a small system, on up to about $45,000 or $55,000 for the larger systems.
So I spend $25,000 for this car, and then 5 years from now, I put another $5,000 in batteries. That sure beats going out and spending another $25,000 or $30,000 to get a new car.
Sure, and the battery technology that you buy 5 years from now will probably be 10 times better than the battery technology we have today.
All right, now, do these cars have what comes in these cars? You get a radio or air conditioner, or what do you get?
If you go to the website at globalgreencars.com, there is a buyer portal there, and we have virtually all the options that are on our vehicles there. Leather interior, air conditioning, premium sound, all those options are on the vehicle. And yes, electric vehicles do have air conditioning. It draws around 3 amps, so you can sit in traffic for an hour in the morning in the heat, running your stereo, running your air conditioner, and while all those gasoline-powered cars around you are pouring money out the exhaust pipe, you're sitting there using almost no energy at all.
So this vehicle, would be suitable for out here in, and I refer to our summers out here as the northern suburbs of hell, out here in the Phoenix area. It'd be suitable for that. It would be suitable for the northern states where it gets hot, but not like down here in the desert. What about wintertime? What about heat?
Wintertime, they have... Now, this is one of the nice things about electric vehicles compared to internal combustion engines. If you live in a cold area, you get out in the morning, it's 20 degrees outside, you get in that car, how long does it take for that car to really start putting out heat? I mean, enough to defrost that windshield and for you to take your gloves off and be able to drive the car on the inside. It's probably, what, 15, maybe 20 minutes in the morning?
Yeah, uh-huh.
In an electric vehicle, when you hit the heater, within 10 seconds, it's hot.
Well, that's cool. That's hot. That's good.
And we also have a proprietary coating that goes on the inside of our vehicles that insulates the steel. So when you're in Phoenix, and by the way, this coating was tested in Las Vegas.
Okay.
On a test building in Las Vegas, which is just about as hot as Phoenix. And it actually, one of the problems that you have in those areas is the buildings heat up during the day. So after dark, the building is still hot. It's still radiating heat. So you've got to run that air conditioner way on up into the night, or else you're just going to cook in that house.
Mm-hmm.
In this building, as the building did not retain any heat. The coating reflected all the sun's heat away from the building and kept the building cool all day long. That's what will be coated on the inside of the vehicles. So there's a 500-watt heater inside the vehicles, and you will stay toasty warm, and you will stay nice and cool in the summertime. The outdoor heat, outdoor temperature will not affect the inside temperature.
All right, if I wanted to buy one of these cars right now, can I do that?
Yes, you can, but you can't drive it over 25 miles an hour. Until that federal motor vehicle safety standard is passed, and we are certified to drive on American highways, the vehicle will not be allowed on the highway, and it won't be allowed over 25 miles an hour. Everybody's got to stay behind the curb with their vehicles right now.
Okay. Now, what you're currently faced with is producing an automobile in competition with car companies that basically don't want it, and they're owned by the government, who gave all the money to those automobile companies.
Well, as I said, we have a rather unique idea about that, that we're kind of a people's car company, and we're still believers that the people of the United States of America run this country, and the government is not going to tell the people what they can and cannot do with their money. If people want to buy these electric cars, they're going to be able to buy them.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Dr. Brooks Agnew. He is the president of Global Green Cars. As always, if you click the guest picture on my website, it will take you to his website. All right, and so it is linked to the Global Green Cars website. Dr. Agnew, you were talking about that you believe that the American people still run the country, and if they want the car, they'll get the car. I don't doubt your resolve, and I don't doubt your business plan. However, there is quite a history in this country of the big giants, the giant corporations, and even the government stepping on the little guy. How are you going to handle that if you're confronted with it?
Well, that's really a good point. And I really don't know how we'll handle that. If the federal government decided to come forward and say it does not serve the public good for independent car companies to make cars, we're going to let the car companies that are owned by the government make the cars, then I'm afraid we have made the final step into fascism. We now have government-owned industry, and we must buy from the government store. And if the American people don't wake up pretty soon, that may be exactly where we're headed. The car industry, the healthcare industry, the education industry is all going to be run by three guys in Washington.
Well, the quality, if people wonder what the quality will be at that point, take a look at Lada cars during the Soviet Union years, or the Yugos during the years which Tito was in power and it was a communist government in Yugoslavia. Just take a look at the quality that they had, and that's where you're headed. They fall apart.
Well, that's true. And the word quality is very relative in our country. Quality to some people might be a little Mazda Miata because they can take the top off and take curves with the wind blowing through their hair. Quality to another person might mean the gentle, comfortable, quiet ride of a Cadillac or a Lincoln Continental or a Hummer. Quality is an individual thing in this country. So, you know, we, more than any other nation on earth, have always had a love affair with the automobile. And I'm hoping, I'm gambling, that the American people will honor that love affair and they will go after the cars that they want to buy, not the ones they're being forced to buy.
What about the road safety of these cars? And I'm not talking about crashes. I know you've got crash tests you've got to do. But because of the weight of the car, I'm going down the highway and a tractor-trailer rig passes me. And I'm in the right lane. He passes me in the left lane. Is he likely to blow me out of the lane?
No. The cars weigh between 2,300 pounds, and I think our little SUV is going to weigh about 3,100 pounds. Compared to the cars that we're used to driving, they're 1,000 to 1,500 pounds lighter. So they're certainly road safe, and they're very stable. This little pickup truck, we paced the Rolex 250 series race at the Miller Motor Park in Tooele, Utah, Saturday. And we were on the track at the same time with 135-mile-an-hour Ford Mustangs. Now, it took us a little longer to get around the track, of course, because the top end of this truck's significantly lower than those Mustangs. But we were taking the corners pretty sharp, and we averaged about 55 miles an hour around the track. The test driver, who happened to be the track manager, was very impressed with the way the truck handled. So they're very safe, and they're very manageable on the road. And a lot of people like them because they're easy to park. And, small is good in a lot of respects.
Okay, now let's talk about the we haven't talked about what kind of speeds can I attain with these electric cars?
Well, stock, we're going to make them safe. The little G1, which is the green and silver car that you see on the front of our website, it has a steel roll cage around the driver. You can see the double bars going around the bottom of the vehicle. All the silver parts are steel, welded steel. The green parts are composite. So right now they're fiberglass. They'll be upgraded to carbon fiber. So you're very safe in that car with respect to accident, to rollover, to side impact, all of that.
Yeah, but what's the top speed?
That car will go about 100 miles an hour. We could make it go faster. My question is, why? Why would you want to go any faster than 100 miles an hour? By the time you get to 80, you're breaking just about every traffic law on the books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we out here in the West and Southwest, we do have long stretches of road that are just through the desert. And right. We have speed limits of 75. But that's not most places. Most places, 55 to 60, 65, that's the speed limit. What about cruise control?
Of course, it'll have all the normal features that you have, cruise control and all of that. But keep in mind, these are commuter vehicles. These are designed to get you to and from work, to and from the store, to and from the soccer game or the football game. They're designed to take you 70, 80, 90 miles between charges.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't go out on a long 100-mile stretch in the desert in an electric vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't be prudent. If I'm going to make a trip longer than 100 miles, I'm going to break out my gasoline-powered car. But if I'm making 10 trips to Lowe's to get nails and screws and glue and tape and a saw blade and all those things I forgot while I'm building my deck in my backyard, I'm driving the electric.
Well, and, you know, just going to work and back. You know, if you live in the same town where you work, then, you know, you could drive the electric car to work and back.
Well, 90% of Americans drive less than 35 miles to work. They could go all the way to work and all the way home without recharging. As you said, most employers are going to be very happy that their employees are thinking green. And there may be carbon credits and different incentives that employers are going to receive from the government, at both state and federal government. The Green Cities initiatives provide grant money for this charging infrastructure. And if it's just a row of 110 outlets, weatherproof, out there on the front side of the parking lot, it's pretty inexpensive to put in.
Well, yeah, and I would think something like that would, at least it should qualify for some type of tax credit for the business. Dr. Agnew, it's been fabulous. Our time has flown, and we're racing now towards the end of the show. I appreciate you for taking the time to be with us this evening. It's been very interesting and enlightening.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kevin. I always enjoy coming on your program. Great show.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Now, tell folks the web address, even though we have it linked. Tell folks a web address again.
Very simple. It's just globalgreencars.com.
Globalgreencars.com. There are some videos on that site where you can watch the test driving of these vehicles. So avail yourself of that. This is futuristic technology, futuristic science on the ground, ready to go. And may be available to us sometime next year. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.